The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
In case number 22-800, Moore versus United States, Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court.
For tax purposes, Congress has long treated some corporations, such as S corporations, as well as partnerships, as pass-throughs. Congress does not tax the entity on its income, but it instead attributes the undistributed income of the entity to the shareholders or partners, and then taxes the shareholders or partners on that income. Since 1962, Congress has likewise treated American-controlled foreign corporations as pass-throughs. That 1962 law, known as Subpart F, attributes certain income, mostly passive, of American-controlled foreign corporations to their American shareholders, and then taxes the shareholders on that income. In 2017, Congress passed and President Trump signed a new tax law that attributes more income, including active business income, of American-controlled foreign corporations to their American shareholders and then taxes the shareholders on that income. The question here, in this case, is whether that 2017 tax is constitutional under Article 1, Sections 8 and 9, and the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. The issue arises in a suit by Charles and Kathleen Moore. In 2006, they invested $40,000 in an American-controlled foreign corporation that one of their friends had started in India. In return, the Moores received a 13% ownership share. The company, Keyson-Craft, generated a great deal of income, but as of 2017, Keyson-Craft had not distributed that income to its American shareholders, including the Moores, meaning that neither Keyson-Craft nor the Moores had paid U.S. taxes on that income. The new 2017 tax, however, applied to the Moores because of their investment in Keyson-Craft. Based on their pro rata share of Keyson-Craft's accumulated income, they owed $14,729 in taxes on that income. The Moores claimed that this 2017 tax was unconstitutional. They argued that it violated the Constitution because the tax, in their view, was in essence a tax on property, namely a tax on their stock holdings, rather than a tax on income. And they argued that the Constitution does not authorize federal taxes on property as opposed to federal taxes on income. The district court dismissed their suit, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed the dismissal. The Court of Appeals held that the tax was, in fact, a tax on income within the meaning of the Constitution because Keyson-Craft earned significant income, and the 2017 tax assigns only a pro rata share of that income to the Moores. This court granted review, and we now affirm. After independence in 1776 and under the Articles of Confederation in effect from 1781 to 1789, the federal government relied primarily on contributions from the states for revenue. The federal government's expenses and needs sometimes far outpaced the contributions that the states were willing to provide. As George Washington famously recognized during the Revolutionary War, reliance on the states to fund the national government hampered important national priorities, including the war against the British. The national government's continuing revenue problems under the Articles of Confederation helped prompt the Constitutional Convention that convened in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. The framers responded to the revenue problem by granting Congress an expansive taxing power. Article 1 of the Constitution affords Congress broad power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Generally speaking, and to oversimplify for present purposes, Congress may impose a tax on your income, but generally not on your property. That is why Americans every year pay federal income taxes, but not federal property taxes. So the issue here basically comes down to whether this 2017 tax is a tax on income or on property. If it's a tax on income, it's constitutional. Tax on property, it's not constitutional. So what distinguishes income from property? The Moores argue that income requires realization. The Moores say that realization occurs when gains come into the taxpayers' coffers, for example, through salaries, wages, or dividends. Critically, however, and this is the key to this case, the 2017 tax does tax realized income, namely income realized by the corporation, Kiesenkraft. The 2017 tax then attributes that income to the shareholders and taxes the shareholders, including the Moores, on their share of it. So the precise and very narrow question that the court addresses today, and we want to stress the only question we address today, is whether Congress may attribute an entity's realized and undistributed income to the entity's shareholders or partners and then tax them on their portions. As we explain in detail in our opinion, this court's longstanding precedents, reflected in and reinforced by Congress's longstanding practice, establish that the answer is yes. In 1925, 1932, and in two cases in 1938, this court already held that Congress can attribute the undistributed income of an entity to the entity's shareholders or partners and then tax them on their share. Consistent with that case law, Congress has long taxed the shareholders and partners of business entities on the entity's undistributed income. Since 1958, for example, the Internal Revenue Code has taxed the shareholders of S corporations. And in 1962, Congress enacted Subpart F, which, as I mentioned, taxes American shareholders of American-controlled foreign corporations on their share of the corporation's income. That's a longstanding tax that is similar in form to the 2017 tax at issue in this case. So in this court, faced with a wall of Supreme Court precedent against them, as well as longstanding practice, the Moores had two choices. They could argue that all of those taxes are unconstitutional and all of those precedents should be overruled, or they could try to distinguish the 2017 tax from those other taxes and argue that only the 2017 tax is unconstitutional. They chose the latter approach. To be specific, they conceded that partnership taxes, S corporation taxes, and subpart F taxes are constitutional. They seek to distinguish the 2017 tax from all of those. But as we explain more thoroughly in our opinion, the Moore's effort to thread that needle, although inventive, is unavailing. Suffice it to say that we conclude that our precedents are on point and control the outcome here. We note that because the Moores cannot meaningfully distinguish the 2017 tax from similar taxes, such as partnerships, S corporations, and subpart F, if we were to accept the Moores' legal theory, that theory, taken to its logical conclusion, could render vast swaths of the Internal Revenue Code unconstitutional. And those tax provisions, if suddenly eliminated, would deprive the U.S. government and the American people of trillions in lost tax revenue, as the government explained to us in its brief and at oral argument in this court. The logical implications would therefore require Congress to either drastically cut critical national programs or significantly increase taxes on the remaining sources available to it, including, of course, on ordinary Americans. The Constitution does not require that kind of fiscal calamity. In sum, based on the text of the Constitution, longstanding congressional practice, and the court's precedents, we reject the challenge to the 2017 tax. That said, we emphasize again that our holding is narrow. It applies only in a pass-through situation. Nothing, in our opinion, should be read to authorize a hypothetical tax on both the entity and the shareholders or partners on the same undistributed income realized by the entity. In addition, as the government itself acknowledges, a hypothetical federal tax on one's wealth or net worth might be considered a tax on property, not income. And as the government further acknowledges, the constitutionality of a hypothetical tax on appreciation could depend on, among other things, whether realization is a constitutional requirement for an income tax. The Moores, as I've noted, argue that realization is a constitutional requirement. The government argues that it is not. But to decide this case, we have no need to wade into that debate and resolve their disagreement over any realization requirement because, as we've explained, the income involved in this case was realized income. So those are all potential issues for another day that may never come, and we'll not reach out to address or resolve any of those issues now. This is only a case about attribution of realized income, and we resolve it on that narrow basis. We affirm the judgment of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Justice Jackson has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Barrett has filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which Justice Alito has joined. Justice Thomas has filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Gorsuch has joined.
In case 2350, Chiaverini versus the City of Napoleon, Justice Kagan has the opinion of the court.
This case began with a series of odd interactions between a jewelry store owner in Napoleon, Ohio, and the police officers in that town. The jeweler, Yasha Chiaverini, bought a ring for $45 from a jewel thief. He was a petty jewel thief. The ring's rightful owners found out and asked Chiaverini to return their property. For some reason, he refused. Then the police asked him to return the ring to the rightful owners. He still refused. And while speaking with the police, he suggested, for reasons that are entirely unclear, that he was operating his store without a license. You can tell my opinion has better facts than Justice Kavanaugh's opinion. The police unsurprisingly turned their attention from the $45 theft to Chiaverini, and soon they charged him with three crimes: receiving stolen property, which is a misdemeanor, dealing in precious metals without a license, also a misdemeanor, and money laundering, a felony. To succeed on the felony money laundering charge, the police would have to show that Chiaverini bought the ring thinking it was stolen. According to the police, Chiaverini told them just that. Chiaverini denies making that admission. But the long and short of it is that the police arrested Chiaverini and held him in jail for 3 days. Later, though, the county prosecutor thought better of the whole prosecution and dropped the charges. Chiaverini thought that what had happened to him was quite unjustified, and so he sued the officers. He brought what is called a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim. To prevail on that kind of claim, a plaintiff must show that a government official brought charges against him without probable cause, and that those charges led to an unreasonable seizure of his person, like a detention, in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So in his lawsuit, Chiaverini tried to prove that the felony money laundering charge lacked probable cause. He argued that the police never had any reason to think he knew the ring was stolen. Their claim that he admitted as much, he said, was an out-and-out lie. But without addressing that argument, the court below ruled against Chiaverini. In that court's view, the police clearly had probable cause to charge Chiaverini with the two misdemeanors. And the court thought that was enough. As long as one charge in the prosecution was supported by probable cause, a malicious prosecution claim relating to other charges in the proceeding also had to fail. Today, we reject that view. We hold that the presence of probable cause for one charge in a criminal proceeding does not categorically defeat a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim relating to another invalid charge. That result follows from both the Fourth Amendment and traditional common law practice. That's enough to resolve this case, but another issue lurks. As I've said, a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution suit depends not just on an unsupported charge, but on that charge's causing a seizure, like Chiaverini's detention. The parties here disagree about whether Chiaverini's seizure was caused by the valid charge or the invalid charge, and how to decide on that sort of question. But because that issue is not properly before us, we leave it for the court below to decide. Justice Thomas has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Alito joins. Justice Gorsuch has also filed a dissenting opinion.
In case 2314, Diaz versus United States, Justice Thomas has the opinion of the court.
This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Delilah Diaz was stopped at a port of entry while trying to drive across the U.S.-Mexico border. Border Patrol searched Diaz's car and found more than 54 pounds of methamphetamine hidden in the car's door panels. Diaz was charged with knowingly importing methamphetamine. In her defense, Diaz claimed that she did not know that there were drugs in the car and suggested that her boyfriend secretly put the drugs there. To rebut Diaz's defense, the government called Special Agent Andrew Flood as an expert witness. He testified that most couriers know that they are transporting drugs. The jury found Diaz guilty. Diaz appealed and challenged Agent Flood's testimony under Federal Rule of Evidence 704B. That rule states that, and I quote, in a criminal case, an expert witness must not state an opinion about the defendant, whether the defendant did or did not have a mental state or condition that constitutes an element of the crime charged or of a defense. The Court of Appeals affirmed Diaz's conviction. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we affirm Rule 704B applies only to opinions about the defendant. Agent Flood, however, did not express an opinion about Diaz. Instead, he testified about the knowledge of most drug couriers. That opinion does not necessarily describe Diaz's mental state. In fact, Diaz may or may not have been like most drug couriers. Diaz herself made this point at trial by arguing that her boyfriend planted the drugs found in the car. The ultimate issue of Diaz's mental state was left to the jury. Agent Flood's testimony thus did not violate Rule 704B. For this reason and others set forth in our opinion, we affirm the judgment of the Ninth Circuit and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Jackson has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Gorsuch has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justices Sotomayor and Kagan join.
In case 22-1025, Gonzalez versus Trevino, the court is issuing a per curiam opinion, which I will announce. In the case of Nieves versus Bartlett from 2019, this court held that a plaintiff bringing a retaliatory arrest claim must plead and prove the absence of probable cause for the arrest. In other words, if you think the police are arresting you for some made-up reason, you can't complain about it unless what they actually arrested you for has sufficient cause. You can't complain about it if they do have sufficient cause. There is a reasonable exception to the rule. You can go ahead with your retaliatory arrest claim, even if there's probable cause for what you were arrested for, unless people similarly situated are not arrested. The easy example is jaywalking. If they arrest you for some, you think, made-up charge, but then say it was for jaywalking, it's enough to show that most people are not arrested for jaywalking, so that, again, your retaliatory arrest claim can still go forward. Now, the facts this case, based on the complaint, is that in 2019, petitioner Sylvia Gonzalez was elected to the City Council of Castle Hills, a small town in southern Texas. Now, after her election, Gonzalez organized a petition to drive out the city manager. She then introduced that petition at a city council meeting. At the end of the meeting, Gonzalez was packing up her belongings and placed the petition in her binder. Another attendee pointed out that she had done so, and she returned the petition, claiming that she had picked it up by mistake. Nevertheless, Gonzalez was arrested for intentionally, quote, removing a governmental record, end quote, in violation of Texas Penal Code Section 3710. Now, when the district attorney learned of the arrest, he declined to press charges. Gonzalez then sued, claiming that she had been arrested in retaliation for seeking to remove the city manager. According to her complaint, in preparation for the suit, she had surveyed data for her county, and it turns out that no one had ever been criminally charged before under Section 3710 for trying to steal a non-binding or expressive document. She argued that this evidence satisfied the Nieves exception. But the Court of Appeals said no. The exception required for her to show other people similarly situated were not arrested when you were. But what she had shown was that nobody was similarly situated. We now vacate and remand. The Fifth Circuit took an overly cramped view of the Nieves exception. The court thought that Gonzalez had to identify a specific individual who was not arrested despite having mishandled a government petition. But although the Nieves exception is slim, such evidence is not required. The arrest data that Gonzalez submitted with her complaint is the type of evidence that can be considered under the Nieves exception. The judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is vacated, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Alito and Justice Kavanaugh have filed concurrences. Justice Jackson filed a concurrence joined by Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Thomas has filed a dissent. Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar.
Judge David Payne.
Judge Payne?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of my daughter, Julia Catherine Payne, a member of the bar of the state of Indiana, and I'm satisfied she possesses all the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and your daughter will be admitted.
Michael Shankman.
Mr. Shankman?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Anya Gabriela Ku of the Bar of the State of California, Jessica Ann Barker, and Michael Caleb Barker of the Bar of the State of Indiana. I'm satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
Wayne D'Angelo.
Mr. D'Angelo?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Zachary Joseph Lee of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Lee will be admitted.
Susan Ebner.
Ms. Ebner?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Sarah Grimmer Urasco of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Urasco will be admitted.
Kevin Daly.
Mr. Daly?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Danielle Racine Menard of the Bar of the State of Rhode Island. I am satisfied that she possesses the necessary qualifications. Thank you.
Your motion is granted, and Ms. Menard will be admitted.
Robert Rosenberg.
Mr. Rosenberg?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Peter Anthony Fole of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Mr. Fole will be admitted.
Shirley Diaz.
Ms. Diaz?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Carla Josephine Kraft and Sean Thomas Lobb of the Bar of the State of California. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the United States Department of Justice presented by the Solicitor General of the United States.
General Prelogar.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the State of California, Kagan Dewey Buchanan, Courtney Lynn Dixon, Benjamin Richard Lewis, Amanda Lee Mundell, Kevin Benjamin Soder, Anna Manchester Stapleton. From the District of Columbia, Maxwell Addison Baldy, Deanna Elizabeth Evans, Matthew Blake Hansen, Catherine Meredith Potty, Hector Gustavo Ruiz. From the State of Illinois, Laura Elizabeth Myron. From the State of Massachusetts, Brian Joseph Farnkoff. From the State of Maryland, Julie Elizabeth Dickerson, Graham Wheeler White. From the State of New York, Vanita Balakrishnan Andrap Alyal, Kara Mead Antel, Ashley Chung Honnold, Leif Eric Overvold, Kaysen Baker Ross. and from the state of Virginia, Sean Reardon Janda, Anna O'Neill Mohan, and Daniel Yee. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from Georgetown University Law Center, presented by Irving Gornstein.
Mr. Gornstein?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the Bar of California, Chelsea Epps. From the Bar of the District of Columbia, Joseph Frank Altieri, Jessica Blair Rigby, Abigail Thea Burton, Adam Thomas Calandra, Brenna Marie Gautam, Kayshawn Lamar Taishim Henderson, Janice Rigorosa Maletti, Vanessa Osaragwe Amaragaman, Jared B. Reifus, Gina Michelle Spade, Crystal Little Weeks, Theodore Joshua Wu. From the Bar of Illinois, Kevin James Cole. From the Bar of Maryland, Jason Yasha Amirhaji. From the Bar of Michigan, Mindy Berry. From the Bar of New York, Sylvia Claudia Calderon, Moya Tamber Gruber, Donaline Vina Roberts, Abdulwahab A.A.J. Sadek, Claire Martha Webster. From the Bar of Puerto Rico, Jessica Hernandez Sierra. From the Bar of Rhode Island, Joseph John Altieri, and from the Bar of Virginia, Melody Lane Vidmar. I'm satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the Bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.